is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, June 10th, 2020. Producing from his studio, home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York. There are no Major League Baseball games in sight yet, but there is a lot of baseball coverage in the hours and days ahead on ESPN. First, don't forget that tonight we'll see the start of the Major League Baseball draft with that broadcast going from 7 p.m. on ESPN all the way to 10:30. There'll be more draft coverage on ESPN2 on Thursday. And then on Sunday night, ESPN airs the 30 for 30 documentary about the summer of 1998. The trailer, here's the trailer in which you'll hear the voices Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa, who both sat for interviews.
McGwire waits, swings, and hits it to deep center. Looks like it's going to leave the park. Adios! Wow!
Sosa set to drive. Deep to right. Oh, baby, long gone.
Have we ever seen anything like this?
We couldn't stop talking about Mark McGwire around here today.
You just don't know when you're going to hit a home run. Obviously, it takes a pitcher, it takes a pitch, it takes a good swing. I'm ready. Ready for the fight.
Watching those two guys, it was poetry.
It ain't coming back.
We got Mark. They got Sandy.
Didn't know anything about Sammy Sosa until he had 20 home runs in June.
The Maris record was hallowed ground.
If it was easy to do, it would have been broken a long time ago.
People were desperate for a feel-good story.
In retrospect, there was a price to pay for it.
I was hungry to be somebody. I was born here on Monday.
We shook the world.
So on the podcast today, we'll be talking with one of the 17 pitchers who allowed home runs to both of those guys that season, longtime big leaguer Andy Benes. Before we get to that, some news and notes for today. Congrats to Denard Span for a sterling career, 11 seasons, over 6,000 plate appearances in the regular season and postseason, 1,498 hits, 773 runs, 185 steals. He was named on the Rookie of the Year ballots in 2008 and MVP ballots in 2014. Denard Span telling MLBTradeRumors.com that he is retiring. The Major League Baseball Players Association has made a proposal to Major League Baseball for a season of 89 games with a full prorated share of salary in addition to expanded playoffs. Sources familiar with the situation told ESPN's Jeff Passan on Tuesday. As Jeff wrote, it would bring the sides closer to a potential deal because it's 25 games fewer than the union's most recent proposal of 114 games at full pro rata. Meanwhile, Taylor, did you hear that sound?
Yep. That's not a baseball burning, Taylor.
The industry to two floors. And here's another piece of sound that feels like it should apply to this moment. It just goes on and on and on. The two sides just sort of edging close to each other. How you feeling about the negotiations, Taylor?
Not great at all. Not at all. It's funny. I mean, we talk about it every day. It's exhausting, actually. But to hear other folks on, you know, different podcasts and networks and radio shows being like, oh, you know, I think they'll get there. I have, you know, minimal hope at best. What about you, man? Like, do you think we get baseball in 2020 right now, as of today?
I do. I think there'll be some product, but the question is, what condition will the industry be in, not only for this year, but moving forward, by the time they actually get there? I can't tell you how many shows that I've done where the first words are, but in baseball, because they run through the, you know, the progress that they're having in the NBA and the NHL and other sports. And then it's always, but in baseball, and we'll be talking with Paul Imbakides about all that coming up. Before we get to Hembo and Andy Benes, we need to mention our friends at Shell. Here's a fact for you. Not all synthetic motor oils are created the same. Crude oil is like a bag of mismatched rocks, all different sizes and shapes coming together. Natural gas is more like a bag of marbles, all uniform in size and shape, designed to work together, reducing friction in your engine. That's why when Pennzoil reinvented motor oil, they started with natural gas, not crude. Pennzoil synthetic base oil is 99.5% free from the impurities you'd find in crude oil. So the next time you need to change your oil, remember to ask for Pennzoil synthetic motor oil made from natural gas. It gives you unbeatable engine protection. The proof is in the Pennzoil, based on Sequence IVA wear test using SAE 5W30.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Why, you worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo Knows.
And Hembo is Paul M. McKeed. He's a researcher for ESPN who's a honcho on the show Get Up. He told us he was the head honcho, but Mike Greenberg corrected him, said that he's just a wild partier that everyone looks up to. Hembo, good to talk with you today.
Same to you. I'm hoping at some point we can eliminate that disclaimer, but I guess today is not that day.
Yeah. You know what? I'm going to email Greeny and ask him if he wants me to eliminate that disclaimer. And I think you know what the answer is going to be.
Yeah, I think you're right.
All right, so another day without a deal in Major League Baseball. We could run through all the details of how they're crawling toward each other in the middle, but we're not going to bother doing that because it just feels like a complete waste of time. The industry is burning from the top down day by day by day. I was mentioning to Taylor that it seems like every show that I do, SportsCenter, Radio Hits, the way I'm brought in now is, and in baseball – meanwhile, in baseball, because all the other sports are progressing and baseball is not. Yesterday, St. Louis owner Bill DeWitt became the second baseball owner in a week to say that the sport doesn't produce a lot of profit in terms of being a place where you can get a lot of cash flow. This was an interview that he did on 590 The Fan in St. Louis. Give a listen.
The players gotten approximately what they did, maybe percentage-wise, based on revenues, a little bit less. But, you know, they have by far, the best deal of any players in any sport. And, you know, that's why you see the other sports coming back pretty quickly, because they're aligned with the players. They've got, you know, the more the revenue, the more the players get, you know, based on a formula. We don't have that in baseball. The players have always fought for whatever they can get in individual negotiations, and it's been to their benefit. The industry isn't very profitable, to be quite honest, and, you know, I think they understand that, but they think, you know, the owners are, you know, hiding profits, this and that, and, you know, there's been a little bit of a distrust there.
Yeah, I did two thoughts about that, about Bill DeWitt, who's one of the most powerful people in the game, Hembo. I'll say for the 1 billionth time, no one wants to hear it. And number two, are you kidding? With the whole thing, it's not profitable. I was thinking of George Steinbrenner's original investment in the Yankees when he purchased the team was $700,000. And it's now worth billions to his family. What do you think?
I mean, DeWitt bought the Cardinals for $150 million. It's worth more than $2 billion now. Buster, this is not a game that the owners should want to play, because it's not a game that they can win for two reasons. The first of which you already noted is the public's never going to be on their side. The public is never going to feel sorry for an owner of a $2 billion organization that is having problems now only because they're unwilling to be nearly as flexible as they should be. The second reason is because it's just not true. I don't want to say he's lying through his teeth, because I do think there's some merit to the notion that businesses are maybe less profitable than the public thinks, especially now. But I'll give you some numbers, Buster, that I think make him look pretty bad, at least in respect to some of these comments. Gross revenues for Major League Baseball last year were $10.7 billion. It marks the 17th consecutive year that the league had seen record growth. And Buster, over the last decade, value of the average Major League Baseball franchise has increased by about 300%. The annual contract of the average Major League Baseball player has increased by about 40%. Now, granted, he talked about revenue, not franchise value. He talked about revenue. But I can go there too, because over the last decade, revenue league-wide has increased by about 70%. Again, players increased by 40% during that time. It's not close. And you wrote a column on Sunday, and I assisted you in illustrating that in each of the three previous collective bargaining agreements, the average player's salary had increased by at least 15% throughout the life of that deal. In this current deal, Buster, it has gone down. Major League Baseball owners are not meeting their players halfway. They're not even coming all that close. So I understand the vitriol on the player side. And for owners to be sort of hiding behind this very, very peculiar, forward-facing proposition here, that it's not honest, and it's not true. It just isn't true. So I'm with you. Like, I think it doesn't make any sense for them to say this, even if it were true. But when you consider the fact that, you know, financially the owners really don't have a leg to stand on here, I think it makes them look a whole lot worse.
I don't know if you saw this story, but about a month ago, it broke in the LA Times that Eva Longoria, the actress, was selling her house in LA. It turned out the sale price was $8.25 million. Did you see who the buyer was?
I did not.
Bill DeWitt.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Evan Longoria, which would have made a lot more sense. But
no. Bill DeWitt bought the house.
Buster, it's sickening. And it's so dishonest. We are. I said this a few times over the last couple months. The time in which we're living now is unprecedented. And the consumers of your product don't want to hear you talk about this stuff. They want to see baseball. Buster, yes. We're trending towards July 4th here, okay? There's only been two times in the last 140 years we haven't had baseball on July 4th. It was in 1981 during that, you know, strike-shortened season. And in 1880, when July 4th landed on a Sunday, and they didn't play baseball on those Sundays that year. We're talking about an unprecedented time. I don't have any interest in hearing the owner of a $2 billion corporation say that his cash flow isn't up to snuff.
All right. Draft coverage tonight on ESPN at 7 o'clock. You've got some draft numbers.
Yeah, it gave me an excuse to look into which teams' draft picks have performed the best and worst, Buster, this decade. I'm curious if any of these really stand out to you. I'll start with position players. Over the last 10 seasons, the Cardinals lead the majors in WAR from drafted players with 147.7. Of course, notable recent hits include Colton Wong, Paul DeJong, Tommy Pham, and Harrison Bader. Over that same span of time, it's the White Sox that have produced the least amount of position player WAR from drafted players, totaling only 18.7. So perhaps it's no surprise that Rick Hahn has used each of his last four first-round picks on position players, anecdotally, some of whom look pretty promising. Moving on to pitchers, Buster, over the last decade, the Dodgers ranked first in WAR from drafted pitchers with 84.6. Now, obviously, Clayton Kershaw, drafted in 06, accounts for a massive chunk of that, but they have hit lately on Walker Buehler and, to a lesser extent, on Ross Stripling. And during that same span of time, the Cubs have produced the fewest WAR from their drafted pitchers with only 9.8. And over the last 5 years, Buster, that number is -0.9. For as much as our conversation has centered on lack of development from some of their position players, their inability to draft and develop arms has been their biggest recent failure.
And by the way, if you were to sit down with Theo Epstein and Jed Hoyer and ask them about, you know, what they've done well and what hasn't gone so well in their time running that team, that's exactly what they would tell you.
It's got to be. They have the oldest staff in baseball, and they've done that's. I mean, you could argue it's the reason this thing collapsed way earlier than it needed to. Like, I think 3 years ago we were saying, is this a dynasty? And now this thing has pretty much crumbled down because they haven't been able to draft and develop a single arm domestically.
Think how much more dire it would be for the Cubs pitching wise if not for the fact that they added Kyle Hendricks in that Ryan Dempster trade that they when Kyle Hendricks was a minor leaguer. They essentially, he was like a guy who was sort of thrown into the deal, and good on the Cubs for identifying him. Besides that, they really had such a difficult time.
Yeah, and like you said, like there's more than one way to skin a cat. So it's one of the reasons why Major League Baseball's draft isn't nearly as popular as football's and basketball's. For one, you don't know the players, and secondly, obviously there's more ways to acquire players in Major League Baseball, and the Cubs are an example of a team that have done so successfully through other means. But I think you and I agree that the amateur draft domestically is still a foundational piece for how teams can become successful, and the numbers bear that out.
Real quick before you go, I don't know if you heard Kylie on the podcast the other day, but he said that based on what he's heard, there are going to be teams that are basically going to stick it to the draftees by saying, look, here's the offer we're going to give you. It's going to be below slot, 10, 15, 20%, whatever it is, take it or leave it. And it's just like, have you not learned anything about how we got to this moment, big picture in the industry, where you're just going to absolutely use every bit of leverage to exploit the players and then wonder why. Wait, they're suspicious? Wait, they doubt that we're being straightforward with them? Are you kidding? That was so depressing to hear that.
I heard Kylie share it. I heard your appall in hearing him say it. I mean, what we're witnessing, Buster, is self-mutilation. And the fact that we haven't had this thing resolved at this point before the draft is a, like, it'll be one more data point that the players use, and they have good reason for it. The thought of cheapening, you know, your top picks, where the relationships matter a lot. That's one thing that you mentioned. Like, these are people. The bosses and the players. Like, this is a boss and employee situation. This is not the foot that you want to start off to begin with, let alone during the middle of probably the most contentious labor situation we've had in 25 years. I couldn't think of a worse idea, and I think he's absolutely right. It's going to happen.
All right, Hembo, thanks for doing this.
All right, later, boys.
Danny Bennett's pitched 14 years in the big leagues, 155 wins, and he began his career with the San Diego Padres, where I met him. I covered the Padres for the San Diego Union Tribune. And Andy, when you and I were talking last week, I mentioned to you that when you guys went out on strike in 1994, which seems particularly relevant for the times, I remember being golf foursome. You guys invited me to play, and I was in your group. And I was always working off the ball that you hit.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but, you know, you're probably the only media person that we invited to play. So that should make you feel good. And I'm guessing that we played a lot of your shots. The course that we played, I remember, was kind of that mountainous course north of San Diego, and it was beautiful, but it was really target-oriented, and it was really hard. So as good as you are, I'm guessing we played a lot of your shots.
Oh, sure. Right. The worst golfer ever. Haven't played since 1997, but I appreciate the positive vibes.
That's right.
So, I wanted to talk to you. We got this special coming out on Sammy Sosa, Mark McGwire, the summer of 98. And you are one of 17 pitchers who allowed home runs to both guys. And when I mentioned to that,
lovely.
Yeah, exactly. When I mentioned that to you, you had a funny line about giving up home runs.
Well, I gave up, I don't know, 380-plus major league home runs, but it really, I don't look at that as being a big deal. I hit 8 home runs off major league pitchers, which is shocking, but I didn't give up any to the opposing pitcher, so I was +8. People said, did you like to hit? And I didn't mind hitting, but I really wanted the other pitcher to have to hit. I didn't want to face a DH. So that's how I look at the home run total. 8
there you
nothing.
Go. You could jack. I remember batting practice watching you and you and Derek Bell and Dave Staytone, as Derek used to refer to him. You know, Andy, you could put on a show on batting practice with the power that you had.
Well, I tell people all the time, if you watch the pitchers, at least the starting pitchers take batting practice, and they didn't have a name on the back of their uniform or anything, you'd think they would be, some of them could be starters on the team. There were a lot of starting pitchers that could hit. And I know St. Louis, when I got to St. Louis, Tony La Russa was here, and he's like, if the pitcher has to bat, which we don't really want to bat the pitcher, but if they have to bat, we want you to be able to, number one, handle the bat. We want you to be able to bunt, try to move runners, because that's really important initially. But he's like, I want you to be a weapon. And so we worked on it. We hit every day, whether we're at home or on the road during the extra group. We'd go in the tunnel and hit, and it really helped. And guys could bunt, guys could hit and run if that was the case. We didn't have to do that very much. But every once in a while, we'd lay into it. But BP was a lot different. And when you know the velocity and you know it's not going to bend, some of us weren't too bad.
All right. You had 2 different stints with the Cardinals, but in the summer of 1998, you were with the Arizona Diamondbacks. And so I just want to start with this. McGwire and Sosa, give me a pure baseball scouting report on where you thought Mark McGwire was in 1998 and what had improved in him as a hitter.
I don't think people realize that he was a really good hitter. He didn't hit 210 with huge power. He hit 280 to 300 with huge power. He didn't swing at a lot of bad pitches. And when you made a mistake, he had a pretty good opportunity to put the barrel on it. And so he wasn't just purely a power hitter. I remember him as being a better low ball guy. He just kind of dropped the barrel on the ball, and that's not as common for right-handed hitters, but he had obviously tremendous power. You talk about BP. That was so much fun to watch him during BP. It was just ridiculous. He would amaze teammates that watched him every day, and we just go out for batting practice just to watch him. I mean, he was phenomenal, but he'd handle pitches throughout the strike zone. If you ever watched him, he never took practice swings on deck. He would visualize. He was very prepared. He knew what every pitcher could do. And he took good quality at bats. He didn't swing and miss a lot, from what I remember. And he was a patient hitter. But when he got a pitch to swing at, he cut it loose.
You mentioned the batting practice. I went when I was in New York Times in 1998. They sent me to do stories on that, on how it really was for the first time where fans were excited. Just they would arrive early at the park just to watch batting practice with Mark and then with Sammy for sure. What was that like?
Well, in St. Louis, they legitimately started opening up the stadium for BP because people wanted to come in, and he was such a hot commodity that was kind of abnormal for most clubs. People just were enthralled by how far he could hit it, and so were his teammates. I said before, we go out in the outfield, and if he put a ball in play in BP, it was probably a home run. I mean, it was so far further than most guys would hit it, but in the old stadium, Busch Stadium, I mean, he's hitting them in the upper deck, and that's just ridiculous. It's so far, and the ball was so high, but he was just so strong, and just a real pleasure to watch hit. And when teammates are going out to watch BP, and you're that's a huge deal. He was just on a different level, and you know, I don't care what he took or what he did, and don't really know a whole lot about that. I just know that guy could flat out hit. And it was really a pleasure to watch.
All right. Sammy Sosa, from your perspective as a pitcher, give me a scouting report on how you would try to work to him.
Carefully. Sammy was a phenomenal hitter. He also had big power. I believe he had over 600 major league home runs. And he could really cover the plate, too. He hit a lot of balls the opposite way. He could stay behind it, let it travel deeper into the zone, and then just rifle it to right center with no problem. And it just tremendous power, bat speed. He was more of an up hitter. He would swing at that slider down and away, and you could get him out with that. But in those years, in the mid to late 90s, he was a really hard out. When you made a mistake, he would typically hit the ball really hard. Now, he would have the tendency as the season would go on. I faced him late in the year a lot of times where, you know, the Cubs weren't as good as they've been recently. And he was trying to hit home runs, and so we could take advantage of that. But when he was dialed in, he was one of the best hitters in the game because he had big power, but he could also hit the ball the other way and hit it with authority. And that was a big part of his game, something out over the plate. He could really drive the ball the other way. Piazza was kind of like that. When balls were up a little bit away, early in my career, I threw hard. I could throw the ball middle away, down, had good control with that. And that was a safe zone. Most guys couldn't hit the ball out the other way. But he was one of those guys that could really hammer it the other way. And that poses a big problem for the pitchers. If he stayed within himself and wasn't trying to just hit home runs, he was a really difficult out. So you'd have to crowd him in a little bit, typically off the plate, because he was quick and could get to the ball inside. But, you know, his only, like almost all hitters, that slider was the toughest pitch for them to hit. I think most of them would say that. Hanging sliders go a long way, but good ones are really hard to hit, and they swing over them. But phenomenal hitter. Another guy with pretty good plate discipline. So you had to be careful with him for sure, and really had to work on keeping the ball down and keeping him aware that you might come in to try to quicken them up to get them out of way down.
All right, McGuire's home run off you in 1998. I looked it up today, June 12th of that year. Grand Slam in St. Louis. This jumped out of me. It was, as they say, June 12th. His 31st of the year, June 12th. Yes. So he was having a good year. It's been a long time ago. Do you have any memory of that particular home run?
I actually do, because it comes up every once in a while, but I'd never faced him before. We'd been teammates, and he had been in the American League. We played together in St. Louis the last half of 97. And so the first at bat, I know he's more of a low ball guy, and I literally three pitches struck him out, three heaters, and he swung through the third one. And so I'm like, okay, I got him. I know what he can do. I don't got what he can do, because the next time I tried to, you know, throw it by him, and it may have been, as we said last week talking, it may have been his shortest home run. I think it's actually in Bank One Ballpark, but it was so high, I thought it might hit the roof. And it was only maybe two, three, four rows deep, but it was hammered straight up in the air. And I just remember that because it was a grand slam. I didn't give up too many of those, but it really hurt me in that game. And I found out really quick, you know, you get guys out one time, but it doesn't mean, okay, I can go back to the well. He was a smart hitter. He was looking for a heater down. He got it, and grand slam. Cost me four.
Sammy Sosa, August 5th, 1998, in Wrigley Field. Again, the number jars you when you see it. On August 5th, his 43rd, hit to deep left center field, the third inning, two-run shot. Do you have any memory of that one?
I really don't, but I don't know. I'm taking your word for it that it was deep left center. The wind must have been blowing out, because, you know, if it was blowing in, he probably couldn't have got it out. He didn't care if it's blown in or out. That guy could flat out rake, but I don't remember that one, but I'm sure if he got it up in the air, it went a long ways.
Now, that, of course, there's a narrative that developed around that season that helped to save baseball. I think it's more complicated than that, Andy, myself. I think Cal Ripken really helped baseball come back from the work stoppage with what he did in 1995. I think fans gradually began to come back. But how do you, as someone who is in baseball, view what those two guys did in 98?
Well, it wasn't fun giving up those home runs. And I actually faced Cal Ripken the day before he tied the record. We were at Seattle, was in town. I faced him on a Sunday. And I just remember Dan Wilson's like, fastball in. And I'm like, I don't want any part of that. you know, I love baseball, the tradition of it. I'm sure it would have helped me probably get him out. And I do think I got him out. But I'm like, I am not going to be the one to miss in, break a bone. I'm not having that. That would be a death wish. So I think what he did is incredible. I think everybody would agree if he didn't play every game forever, he probably would have better numbers, but it was just a testament to how hard the guy played. He wasn't playing five innings a day. He was playing a premium position, you know, a premium hitter, and to do it that long was incredible. I was in Seattle in 95 when I faced him, and then we had an epic series against the Yankees, and I think that brought back the Mariners won for the first time, and they had premium guys like the big unit, Griffey, A-Rod, was just getting started. Edgar Martinez, that team was just loaded. And that was exciting. And I agree, it's a lot more complicated than that. But nobody wins when there's a work stoppage. It's tough for both sides. I see both sides and can understand. And so fans want to watch baseball. But things like that are really exciting. You know, I played in the steroid area or the HGH. I was not involved in any of that. I probably would have been better if I did, but I think the biggest thing with that was, you know, it helped guys recover and go out and play and be better. They're still very, very talented, but with those guys going back and forth with home runs, it was just different than what people had ever seen. And they were both dynamic players. They were the best player on both teams. And people really got into it. Even as an opposing player, you know, we're playing on the West Coast and we would watch those guys hit. You know, Sosa would be playing during the day and we'd get into the ballpark and we'd watch those at bats because everybody was excited to see, okay, what are they going to do today? And any pitch of any at bat, they could have hit it out. So, there are a lot of things I think that helped baseball kind of come back, but there was so much excitement with that, that I think it really maybe that next generation of fans, because people like watching home runs. I hated it. that was one of those things, you know, any of the pitchers you talked to that gave up those home runs weren't really that excited that they hit them, but it's exciting for baseball. I think fans would rather see games where home runs are being hit than, you know, a 2-1 game. But the pitchers certainly would vote for the 2-1 game, but very exciting time. And, you know, just to be a part of that era and playing at that time was pretty cool.
Do you have a memory when McGuire broke the record, hitting a low line drive off of Steve Traxel? And then, of course, the thing that was amazing was that, you know, they were playing the Cubs and Sammy was there and the two of them shared in that, and they're sharing hugs, and Mark is sharing it with the Roger Maris family. Is anything, do you have a clear memory of watching that play out?
Well, I remember watching the home run. I don't remember what time of day it was. It was a night game, day game, but I remember watching him hit it. It may have been his shortest home run of the year. I don't think there could have been one shorter, but I think when I think about Big Mac and that whole run, he loves baseball. He loved the history of the game. And so he knew that it was an epic moment, and, you know, it's a huge part of Major League history. And so he was so respectful of and cared about the Maris family because of that, because he loved the game and the past. And it was just super cool to see that. You don't see guys giving hugs running around the bases. Guys are competing and wanting to win, but it was beyond baseball at that point for both of those guys. And so I think they relished that opportunity. They both wanted to be the guy with the most at the end of the year, but it was for everybody in baseball, I think it was just a super cool thing to watch. And to, I'm sure there were probably 400,000 people that said they were at Busch Stadium that day, right? the legend keep growing, but a super exciting day. And that year was just an amazing year with those two battling it out.
What kind of teammate was Mark?
I tell people all the time, you know, you covered the Padres, and Tony Gwynn was a superstar. He didn't act like that for sure. He was a humble guy, but they're on a different level than the regular Major League guys. You know, Major League, if you make it to the Major Leagues, you're a really, really good player, right? And you've covered all these guys. You realize the talent that they have, but there's a different focus, expectation, burden for those guys. I just got done watching the Jordan documentary, and people don't realize, hey, when they go on the road, or this guy can't just go to the mall and walk around and, you know, kill some time before the game. He's got to stay in his hotel room. And Mark was like that. And there was just a lot more pressure. I remember asking him for an autograph one day. I'm like, hey, listen, man, could you sign a ball? I forget who it was for. I didn't have anything from him, but he's like, oh my gosh, it never ends. And I looked at him and I'm like, Matt, you sit there on getaway day and sign 200 items for the other team. It was amazing. He'd come in and sit in the laundry room and sign items because the other teams coming in and the players wanted that. And he did it for every team. And I think at some point you get tired of it, right? Because you just get tired of it, and he's on a different level. And I'm like, forget it. I don't want it. He goes, no, seriously, bring it back. And I'm like, no, I don't want it. That kid doesn't want it. You know, I was kind of busting his chops. And I pitched the next day. He hit two home runs. he broke his bat, his last at bat, with a single. And I remember it was like home run number 568, 569. So he was close to the end. Broke his bat. The next day I walked in and there was a bat in my locker. That bat, say, congrats, Andy. Great win. Mark McGwire, home runs number, and out of the blue. And he would sign stuff for the starting pitcher that got the win. He'd sign a pair of shoes for him. But there's just a different expectation, and it's hard to understand that. And so as a teammate, he was pretty quiet. He went about his business. He was happy to help anybody. But it's hard for those guys. And even as a teammate, you don't realize how difficult it is for them with the pressure. I played with Albert the first 2 years of his career, and AP, with the pressure he has and the burden that those guys have, Griffey was like that. The premium guys of the era that are superstars in the game, it's a different deal. And whether it's a teammate, fans, they get inundated with stuff, and it makes it really hard. So they have good days and bad days. I happen to catch him on a day where he's like, oh my gosh, I just got done signing this. And so as a teammate, I'm like, fine, go ahead, do your own thing, sign for whoever, but I don't want it. But very gracious. And I know he signed a bunch of stuff for his teammates that year that was very special. And he usually would go out of his way to try to accommodate everybody. And I think that's a pretty special thing, especially being in the position that he was in.
Yeah, I covered the closest thing I saw. You know, Tony had some of that in San Diego. I covered Jeter in New York. Derek Jeter, New York, and I told friends all the time, like, I would not want that guy's life, because he just would, you know, he couldn't go anywhere without somebody asking him for something, and I'm sure for Mark it was right. Like that as well. You touched on this, Andy, a little bit, where you said, you know, obviously that since the end of his career, Sammy's career, more talk about, you know, PEDs, but right. I've known you for a long time, and I knew you had made your peace with it. As you know, there are some guys, some of your peers, who look back at that time almost like the way some players look at the Astros in recent sign stealing, like something was taken away from me because other guys were doing things and I wasn't. But it sounds like you've made your peace with that.
You know what? I live my life that I've made, first of all, just for this discussion, I made a lot of really poor decisions in my life, and there are consequences to those. I'm very thankful that, you know, none of them were life altering, but at the same time, all I can do is do what I do, and I would prepare. And, you know, those two guys, you didn't ask me, those two guys are bona fide Hall of Famers. There are guys, as you know, that have done PEDs that are in the Hall of Fame. These guys are maybe not as liked as them, just like Barry Bonds. People say, I'll ask me all the time, who was the toughest hitter? Bonds is probably the best player to ever play. I mean, now I didn't play against Babe Ruth and some of these guys, but Bonds stole bases. He could hit for a high average. He hit 73 home runs when guys weren't pitching to him. And you watched it. I mean, it's just crazy talent. The only thing he didn't do very well was throw the ball from the outfield. So a lot of guys did things that weren't, that, you know, they flew under the radar, and some didn't. And it's unfortunate that the guys that did it, that flew under the radar, they aren't looked at as, you know, they're not looked at as cheaters or anything like that, where the guys that actually got caught or fought a suspension or were suspended, whatever it is, you know, they have paid the price. But at the end of the day, baseball's baseball. I faced a lot of those guys. I didn't mind the guys that were going to hit home runs anyway. The hard part for a pitcher was when you have middle infielders that could take you deep the opposite way. That was a game changer, and that was a little frustrating. But I think at the end of the day, as I said, as far as a pitcher goes, all I could do was control what I could control, which was going out and making pitches and give my team the best opportunity to win, be durable, be consistent. And I felt like I did that for the most part of my career. And so I don't look at any of those guys as, I just look at them as, you know, they made mistakes. They did it individually. I think for a team, I look at the Astros and, you know, I don't want to throw stones. That's different. When, you know, it's one thing to be stronger, quicker, recover faster because you're taking stuff to help yourself. But when you know what's coming, and I made the comment, I was watching, I think it was the first World Series they were in, when Clayton Kershaw, who is one of the best pitchers in the generation, when they're spitting on curveballs, they're taking sliders from other guys that are strike the ball and hitting, you know, counts where guys swing at them 97% of the time and they're spitting on them. I'm sitting there with my son, Drew, who you knew as a little toddler probably. And I said, they know what's coming. It just doesn't. I mean, these guys are good, but they know what's coming. Guys aren't going to face Chapman and know that a slider is coming. Or, right? And they're not, and even if they do, they're, you know, they're probably not going to hit that. And so I think that's a totally different thing. And I understand why people are irritated about it. I can see why, you know, I look at the Dodgers, you know, they lose 2 years in a row, right? Or I may have that wrong, but
yeah,
you know, their career numbers are different. The way people may look at Kershaw because of playoff stuff is different. You know, he's a Hall of Famer and he didn't do this or, well, it's different when the batters know what's coming. Doesn't mean they're going to hit it every time, but man, is that a big advantage? I would have liked to know. I'd have taken every off-speed pitch probably, you know, at least it's just different. And so I look at those as being a little bit different. Are they both doing things outside the rule? Yeah. But that is, you know, steal signs from second base, whatever, that's been done since baseball started. But that, you know, knowing what's coming and going to the extent that they went. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, I looked at some of the splits, the Gurriel, I think, he hit the same at home on the road. It wasn't everybody else that I looked, it was, I mean, it's drastic. I mean, it was drastic, and it's too bad, but it's what it is, and you move forward, and, you know, those guys will have to live with it. There'll be some tarnishing, but unfortunately, guys didn't benefit. Guys lost money. Guys lost maybe jobs, and those guys got paid more, got contracts, and now they may have gotten those anyway to some degree, right? But it's just a different deal. And I think that's why a lot of people are, you know, irritated with that. And I think they have a, you know, they have a right to be. But
I was going to say, I'm glad that you stated the obvious about the Hall of Fame, because I say this every year when the Hall of Fame vote comes up. And look, Joe Morgan is, you know, one of the greatest second baseman of all time. Unbelievable player. But when he wrote a letter 2 years ago talking about the Hall of Fame is a sacred place and we have to keep PED guys out of it, I was like, there are already guys in the Hall of Fame that use PED.
Yeah,
and I'm not going to get into them individually. I don't want to throw anybody under the bus. But at the same time, it's like, oh, please. It's a baseball museum, and a lot of guys made choices. But you can say it better than I can.
Pete Rose has over 4,000 hits. Now, if you were taking a fantasy draft, would people draft a guy that hit a lot of singles? Probably not. I'm drafting Bonds or Sosa or those guys, right? But the guy put up those numbers, and he did it. He didn't do it from what I understand, you know, with any, you know, chemical help or anything like that. He played a long time, and he just kept doing what he did great. Did he screw up? Yes. But there are a lot of guys, like you said, and I could go back in the last 20 years in the era that I played in and said, that guy did something, that guy, and some of them actually got in trouble for it. And they're still, you know, they're still voted in. And I think a lot of it is, you know, with Bonds, hey, he's not well-liked. People don't like him. Was he a great teammate? I don't know. I wasn't a part of it, but teammates say, you know, he wasn't a great teammate. Well, he had pressure. You know, it's just different with superstars. So they're treated different. They have a lot of pressure. But those guys put up numbers, and it's what it is. I think it's hard to say, yeah, we'll let this guy in or not. Do they suspect these guys did things? Yeah, but I think people would be shocked with the guys that the players would say, yep, he did it, he did it. And it's just about every year. And unfortunately, the guys that were great that didn't do it, people are all, you know, they're gonna wonder. There are a lot of guys like Jeter, and I would be shocked if he did anything. I don't know. I'm not saying him, but I'm just saying guys that played a premium position like that, that weren't home run guys, that did a lot, that did it. And just to be clear, I'm not saying him, but I'm using him because he's an infielder and he wasn't a home run guy. But it wasn't just home run guys that did it. And every year guys are going in that you're like, yeah, that guy, yep, I know. And it's just, as a baseball guy, I don't think you can pick and choose based on whether you like the guy because he was likable and fan friend. I don't think you can do it like that. You know,
no.
I just think you got to say, okay, this is what this guy did. These are the numbers he put up. And, you know, it's not a morality test. There's a lot of issues with guys that are in, but it's what it is. And hopefully that's why I brought up, man, those guys are Hall of Famers. I mean, some of the best to ever play the game. And so we're going to say, well, we don't really like you or whatever and leave you out. I think that's pretty tough. And guys may say they don't care, but it's a really big deal. You don't hit 500 plus home runs or you're not the home run leader of all. I look at Barry Bonds, and I already said that guy by far was the best player of the time I played. And to hit 73 home runs when you might get 2, 3, 4 pitches a game to swing at. I mean, he walked a couple hundred times, and he was not going to go out of the strike zone. He was a great hitter, a great average hitter, a great home run hitter. That guy was just an absolute stud. And it's hard to believe that a guy like that with that much talent, he's going to be left out. I was excited for Larry. Larry Walker was a great player, a great teammate, he played the game the right. If you have a kid, you say, well, watch that dude play. He's how you play the game. You play the game hard. If I saw a guy hit a ground ball up the middle, Coors Field, and get a double on a ground ball up the middle, well, you don't get that if you're not playing the game really hard and you're not really smart and you can't run and you can't hit. It doesn't happen, right? And so I think, hey, look at the numbers and say, okay, here it is. These are the guys, because they're all great. And I think you're splitting hairs when you pick and choose.
That's I agree with box. You.
I get home runs all of them. Larry Walker hit a home run 1 year, the opening series in St. Louis, and the barrel of the bat was out by the second baseman, but he hit it off the barrel and it went out. And I'm like, you just hit a ball. You broke your bat. He goes, no, I hit it on the barrel. I go, well, I know that. It went over the bullpen, but just a great, you know, having the opportunity to compete against those guys that were the best in the world. And they were on just such a higher level was just a privilege. So.
All right, Danny. Well, I appreciate time and your perspective, and I always look forward to talking with you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I was one last thing. The only reason I knew I gave up home runs to those two guys, the Cardinals did something really sweet. They had pictures. It was just really a nice gesture. Obviously, Big Mac was playing in St. Louis, but they were going to have a picture of a home run swing, but they had the guys when they came into St. Louis, and I was coming in as a Diamondback, sign around all the guys that gave up those home runs that year around the border. And it was just a really cool gesture. So that was the first time that I really thought of, oh yeah, I gave up home runs to both those. I gave up so many. It was, you know, it was like, yeah, that's not shocking, but yeah, I thought it was a really cool gesture and something that those two guys will have forever as a memory of, man, that was some kind of special season for both of them.
Well, you know what? You were part of history. Ralph Branca, gave up that home run, the season-ending home run for the Brooklyn Dodgers, 1951, to Bobby Thompson, and they became close friends because they both understood they shared in baseball history. Same things happened with Kirk Gibson and Dennis Eckersley. So that's pretty cool, Andy.
There's a tight fraternity, and someone was telling me in the last 6 months or so, I didn't know how many guys had ever played Major League Baseball, but there's less than 20,000 people that have ever lived, I think, that have played Major League Baseball at some point. And that's a pretty tight fraternity, and guys respect what guys can do. They're doing the best they can to get them out or get swing, you know, hit them, hit the pitchers, but it's a tight fraternity, and there's a high admiration for guys that do it at the highest of levels. And those guys both did it at a very high level for a long time. So,
and so did you. To them. I appreciate it, Andy.
You bet, Buster. Always good to talk to you.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Wednesday. But before we get there, we are all about our internal products here at ESPN, and we continue promoting them. Don't forget Jalen Jacoby's The After Show podcast with Long Gone Summer director AJ Schnock. You can find that wherever you get your podcasts following the airing of Long Gone Summer on Sunday, June 14th at 9 p.m. Eastern time. And a reminder that all 30 for 30 films are available on ESPN Plus immediately after airing. And one more note about the draft tonight that starts at 7, that goes to 10:30. And then the second round will air tomorrow night. That's June 11th from 5 p.m. to 11 p.m. on ESPN2. And in total, ESPN platforms will carry nearly 10 hours of live Major League Draft coverage. The event will also be streamed on the ESPN app. So let's go to tweets. First up, Charlie B at A Fish and His Chips. Shout out to Fish and Chips, delicious dish. He says, seeing that 21 teams manage the feat of passing on Mark Trout, it's a cautionary tale for every Major League Baseball draft night. So what in your experience has been equally terrible or even worse examples of teams overlooking greatness in the past?
Before I answer Charlie's question, Taylor, it feels a little weird not hearing from the Bleacher tweeters directly after the show yesterday.
I know, right? What a very well received. Everyone seemed to enjoy it, and I think we're going to have to do something like that again in the future.
Yeah, when baseball completely burns down, or they actually get a deal and we move forward, maybe we'll do that again. You're 100% right. Charlie B, there is no greater example of mistakes made in the draft than what we saw with Mike Trout. The interesting thing is, and I learned all this when I was worked on an E60 on Trout, which you could find, I'm sure, a few years ago, that, look, I think clearly the reason why he lasted so long in the draft was the fact that he lives in the Northeast and he didn't play a lot of baseball. So there weren't a lot of games, you know, for players who live in the Northeast and don't travel a lot, they don't get as much as exposure as, say, players in Texas or Florida or California. So the interesting thing about Trout is there clearly was an enormous split where there's some teams that didn't seem to be that aware of him. That's why he fell so long. And on the other hand, the Yankees brought him into Yankee Stadium and they had him do a workout for them. And Taylor, what I heard after the fact was that Mike's dad, Jeff, asked one of the Yankees people, I heard this story the other day, asked the Yankees people, so you think my kid, like, you know, he's going to be okay, like being a major leaguer? And the Yankee scouter talked to him, said, yeah, he's going to be one of the greatest players ever.
Wow.
Phenomenal athlete. And it must have been heartbreaking for the Yankees because the pick with which the Angels took Mike Trout was a compensation pick based on the fact that the Yankees had signed Mark Teixeira, and the Yankees still had a pick in the first round, and they were sitting there, and as Trout lingered and lingered and lingered and lingered on the draft board, the Yankees started to get more hopeful, and he was taken one pick in front of where the Yankees select.
Oof, brutal. Next up, and last one for today, Eric Sorensen at Coach Sorensen 9. He writes in, as a farmer here in the Northwest, we are getting to harvest. Missing listening to the Mariners on the radio while we work. What are some of your memories working on the farm and listening to baseball? He says his dad and him spent many nights in the shop listening to the Mariners.
Yeah, I we didn't have a television. We had this little silver Zenith radio, and I would take it to the barn every night when I would shovel out the barn, or I'd feed the cows hay at night. And I would always take that with me everywhere I went. And when I was playing wiffle ball out in the backyard, I always had it going. You know, I was listening to Red Sox and WDEV in Waterbury up until 8 o'clock, and then their signal would be diminished. Oh. And so at that point, I would switch to trying to find National League games because I was a Dodger fan with the radio waves bouncing. So I listened to baseball every day growing up on the farm.
Cool stuff. Thanks for the question, Eric and Charlie. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. Keep sending them in, please.
That's it for today. My thanks to Andy Bennis, to Hembo, and to Taylor. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on race is something we must fight every day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.